Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ramzi Kanaan. He's been involved in attempting to disseminate the good word for well over 3.5 decades now. As a young teenager, he founded AK Press, named after his mother's initials, from his bedroom in Scotland. He is a co-founder and publisher with PM Press. You can check out his current efforts at www.pmpress.org. So first, as always, thank you for your great work, Ramzi, and then also thank you for being on the program.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we should probably let people know that the strange sounds in the background are your children, correct?
They are my children. I have twin boys who are heading towards 3 years old and being very vigorous about it.
and actually, one of them had a cameo in our last interview.
That's right. I remember.
So we'll move from laughing to crying by... I remember last spring, I sent you a note asking how you were doing, and you said that you felt like you were watching over the collapse of the book industry. So what I'd like to talk about for the whole time is, A, the collapse of the book industry, and B, what that means for society at large, and C, what that means for social change. So first, for a while, can we talk about the collapse of the book industry?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I've been involved in this sordid business for well over 35 years now. I first got involved in 1979 and at the tender age of 13. So I guess those who are mathematically enabled can figure out how old I am now. But pretty much ever since I've been involved in the book trade and in publishing and book selling, the book trade has been in kind of one crisis or another. So a kind of a series of crises, shall we say. So in the early 80s, some folks listening may remember and other folks might be aware, there was the first crisis, which was the cannibalization, shall we say, of independent publishers by the majors, by the big conglomerates, by the Rupert Murdochs, by the von Holtzbrinks et al. So what you saw in the 80s was venerable and formerly independent publishers such as, for example, Penguin or Random House being bought up by these big media conglomerates, Sony, etc. And what that meant for publishers was it meant that, of course, whenever there is a merger or acquisition, so to speak, to use the business vernacular, that's never an expansion. That's always, in effect, a retraction. So when, for example, Rupert Murdoch bought, of course, the name eludes me now, one of the venerable publishers, what it meant in reality was that the so-called mid-list authors were basically cut entirely. So when the likes of Rupert Murdoch bought various publishing houses to add to his empire, when he sent in the dreaded bean counters, the accountants, what they very quickly figured out was that on the face of it, publishing is actually not a commercially viable proposition. So the so-called gentleman's profession of publishing, where the publisher, who is typically was of course a gentleman, not a gentlewoman, but was an independent man of means and who believed in the noble art of publishing for the sake of literature or for the sake of a particular set of ideas or ideals that he was willing to promote. The same, of course, in the case of journalism, where kind of your famous crusading journalists and publishers typically funded themselves or had wealthy patrons to do so. What it meant that, so the art of publishing, of so-called investing in an author, the presumption that the author's first book would not be necessarily the blockbuster, but an author was someone to be encouraged, nurtured, edited, so to speak, and that would develop their craft through a series of novels, of books, of collections, of poetry, whatever it might be. So when the bean counters moved in the 80s, they very quickly discovered that selling 3,000 or 4,000 copies of a book didn't make economic sense. And hence those authors were wholesale kind of laid off and downsized. So entire lists were cut. So this kind of went on kind of through the 80s. In the 90s, concomitant to that.
Wait, but before we get there, can you talk for a second about just sort of bring home the social effects of why would anybody accept one of those mid-list authors who now suddenly has to get a job? Why would anybody else care? Why would we as a society care if the mid-list authors are getting cut?
Well, of course, that's the bigger multi-billion dollar question. But
do you want to deal with that when you're all done?
Yeah, well, I think yes. I think we'll come back to that.
Okay, great. Sorry.
So I'll very quickly go through the next two phases.
Oh, no, take as long as you want. It's all great.
Of the terminal decline and the ongoing assault, shall we say, on publishing. So the second happened in the 90s, where it wasn't from the publishing end, it was from the dissemination end, and that was the rise of the so-called chains. So I'm very sorry about this. That was my phone, I apologize. So the rise of the so-called chains in the US, that was primarily Barnes & Noble and Borders. In the UK, it was a chain called Waterstones. And what the chains did was, following and seeing the success of both... Excuse me one second. Hello? Hey, Arnold, can I call you back? This is... Okay. Very sorry about that. The joys of running a business from your home. So what the chains did is they looked at the success of the rise of the independents, which were an outgrowth of the 70s primarily, and not only what those bookstores were selling, which was typically books by independent publishers, but also the success of some of those independents. So, for example, if you cast your mind back in the early 80s, there's a major Hollywood film about Gandhi. And Gandhi's autobiography, heretofore published by a small Indian publisher and distributed by a small radical pacifist kind of Gandhian distributor in the UK, was bought illegally by Penguin and became an international bestseller. So what the chains thought was, well, these kind of books sell well and these kind of bookstores seem to be doing well. So they aggressively tried to replicate that model by pretty much opening up big chain stores across the road, typically from successful independent bookstores, and by aggressively discounting the kind of bestsellers, the New York Times bestsellers, basically put the vast majority of independent bookstores out of business. So this is kind of was going on in the 90s, so to speak. And then the last kind of nail in the coffin was the rise of the internet. And that whole kind of culture, shall we say, which if folks can remember, when the internet was first touted and first mooted in the kind of early to mid-90s, it was the information superhighway. I believe that was Al Gore's little baby, so he claimed. It was actually the little baby of the American military, but that's another story. And that very quickly changed to being a good consumer and staying at home and shopping online. And there was the rise of Amazon, and that put further pressure on the dissemination end of things. The end result of these three kind of trends were that total book sales in America have continued to fall since about the year 2007. And the kind of the rise of ebooks is actually really a kind of an irrelevant side story to all of this. Well, not really irrelevant, but it really is a kind of an obscure sideshow, because total book sales have continued to fall each year and to fall in every single category of publishing, with the exception of romance novels, who actually have seen an increase. But in every other category of fiction and non-fiction, sales are actually falling. And when I say sales are falling, that is the total sales combined of all formats, meaning hard copy and ebooks. So why ebooks are a kind of barely relevant footnote to this bigger picture is that all ebooks are doing are cannibalizing a shrinking market. So that's the kind of state that the book trade has found itself in, shall we say, today, and why I'm claiming that it really is kind of collapsing. In many ways, it's very analogous to what the music industry has been going through over the last kind of decade. I think the book trade is probably about 3 or 4 years behind the kind of music trade.
And so I want to ask you a specific question, and then let's jump to a larger social question. The specific question is, so when the chains came in and they would heavily discount the bestsellers, I'm wondering obviously every independent bookstore is different, but where did independent bookstores make their living? Because the people who ran them obviously had to pay the rent. And did they often have like a little bestseller section that would make them money? Every time Stephen King comes out, then they make a little bit of money to pay the rent, or did they make their money nickel and dime on every midlist or every pacifist book or every anarchist book or every environmentalist book or whatever, you know, sort of niche they had?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both. So at their best, either independent bookstores provided a niche, as you said, that wasn't being otherwise filled. That might be politically, in the sense of what came out of the various social movements of the 60s, which typically means actually the 70s, there was the rise of pretty much you name it, gay liberation, the feminist movement, Black Power, et cetera, et cetera. Not only did all of those various forms of struggle produce a literature, which heretofore typically hadn't existed. I mean, before the women's movement, the concept of even something as kind of generally banal as women's fiction before the 60s literally didn't exist. So I don't even mean like, you know, sort of rabid so-called bra-burning texts which are, you know, assaulting capital and the state and patriarchy head-on. I mean, fiction written by women, whether or not it even addresses the kind of so-called female experience, that concept didn't exist before the 60s. Before there was black power, black liberation, there was no such thing as black literature. Before gay liberation, there was no such thing as gay literature. So these movements, more or less organized or not, not only brought with them this kind of outpouring of expression and ideas, but also, given that the mainstream at the time was not purveying, so to speak, or disseminating such information, it also, there was the rise of feminist bookstores, of gay bookstores, of black bookstores. So they were filling this kind of, they're doing a kind of dual purpose, both kind of filling this need or this desire or this interest, but also helping to nurture and promote such desires, such interests, I say, whether they're political, social, or otherwise. So that's kind of at the more political end. At the more kind of generic and a good bookstore is a part of the community. So a good bookstore sells books because the community that it serves have an interest in that bookstore, or rather have an interest in books in general. I mean, many bookstores, for example, specialize in kids' books, or they may specialize in fiction. So what a good bookstore does is it's not only able to have a kind of deep and wide variety of whatever it specializes in, so not just the New York Times bestsellers, but you know, if the New York Times bestsellers are mainly blockbuster fiction and mainly kind of self-help kind of diet and fitness books, nevertheless, a good independent bookstore would have a much broader array of good quality fiction, much deeper backlist, as it's called, and similarly might have a much broader array of books on self-help and fitness and diet, you know, none of which are bad things in and of themselves. So a good bookstore is responsive to the kind of that local interest. And like, as we said, with the kind of political bookstores, also helps to foster, to recommend, to sort out the kind of good from the bad. What the chains did is kind of homogenize that into just what sells, i.e. the bestsellers. So it kind of really kind of squeezes into a terribly narrow focus, whether it's women's fiction or whether it's books on diet or self-improvement, into, yeah, I can say a horrible kind of bottleneck.
Well, there's a few directions I want to go with this. Everything you're saying is so interesting to me. And one of the directions I want to go is, when I've done talks at bookstores, or before I ever did any talks at bookstores, my first book came out and I was going to do some, there was an experienced author. I was at the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Convention or whatever it was, and some experienced author, he told me things like where to sign the book. You know, it's like, when you sign a book, here's where you sign it. And he also said, when you go do a bookstore, you're not actually trying to sell books to the audience, because there's only going to be, you know, 20 people there, 40 people there, 10 people there, 3 people there, whatever. He said, what you're really trying to do is make a relationship with the bookstore. Because in independent bookstores, especially, I'm just validating what you said, that in independent bookstores, what's going on is that the people who hear you talk will then recommend your book to, you know, anybody who comes in the store and says, hey, I want a book about this subject. There is that relationship.
Absolutely. And I think that has been in the trade, it's called hand selling. You know, often you will see it if you go into a bookstore and they'll have kind of, you know, staff picks or staff recommends. But more often that's to do with the customers of a bookstore and the staff actually having a relationship. Hey, I remember last month you really bought this book. Well, we just got this one and you'd really like that one, because I have some understanding of where your tastes lie or your interests are heading. So exactly, it's that kind of personal recommendation. And it's Amazon, with its kind of weird algorithms, actually tries to recreate, with its people who bought this will like that, which is an incredibly imprecise and occasionally hilarious, you know, way of, I mean, one of the classics of Amazon was when they had people that like Martin Luther King will also like Planet of the Apes, for example, was one of their algorithms. So, you know, I say occasionally hilariously and horrendously, you know, the algorithms come up spectacularly weirdly. But yeah, that's what Amazon is exactly trying to recreate, that kind of human interaction and experience, which is so vital on so many levels.
So the next direction I wanted to take this for a moment is, there was a used record store back in the 70s when I was a teen that I used to go to all the time. And discovering Rory Gallagher, the Irish guitarist, was a major moment in my understanding of corporate control, because I remember one day at work, we would listen to radio all day, and we started keeping track. And I remember one summer, I think it was 78, 79, they played 8 Van Halen songs through the 8-hour workday. And the reason I bring up Rory Gallagher is because he was fabulous, and I'd never heard of him until I happened to pick up one of his albums at the used record store and put it on the turntable. And my point here is that I realized that radio is basically, for the most part, the mainstream radio stations were ways to promote 10 bands or 20 bands. And yep. Why is it that we hear Van Halen 8 times a day, the Eagles 7 times a day, Led Zeppelin 3 times a day, and you never ever hear of all these other other bands who might be incredible, but for whatever reason they don't get airplay, and they're just as talented or more so. And so, do you see what I'm trying to get at with bookstores? And then, so
bookstores serve a similar function, and so the I say the beauty of the independents, as I alluded to before, is that they have the kind of interest and hence the breadth of titles that they're willing to stock, which the chains are predicated on the quick and easy profit and turnover. So basically, as are the major labels, whether that's a record label or a book publisher, the kind of the majors are interested in churning out lots of stuff, whatever is perceived to be trendy, and throwing it all at the wall and hoping that one of them will be the next blockbuster. For the 999, which are not the next blockbuster, they are immediately discarded. So one of the things, again, one of the benefits of the old independent bookstore was an independent bookstore would expect to, quote, turn its inventory, meaning to sell its inventory 3 times a year, was their kind of margin of operation. Meaning your average book in the store, they'd expect to sell 3 copies a year. Now, obviously, they'd hope to sell more of some, but also hence less of others, if that's an average. Meaning there are certain books which deserve to be on the shelf because they're great books, and one day someone is going to want to read it, and it should be available for them that one day. The typical turn rate for the major chains is 30 days, meaning if that book hasn't sold within a month, it's immediately returned. So it's, again, it's that kind of instant gratification of what's tomorrow's hoped for bestseller, and if it's not, it's already history.
So, but isn't Amazon then a really great thing because the books can stay there forever? Well, you know, short term forever. So I can get a book that might have been taken. There's a local bookstore that I just love, Jefferson State Books, up here in this county. The guy is so courageous to open a bookstore in this economy and in this collapsing industry. But that doesn't alter the fact that he's only got, you know, X number of square feet. And so if I want a book, I can go to him and I can order it and maybe get it in a couple of weeks, or I can click over to Amazon, buy it for, I don't know, $15 instead of $25, and I can get it in 3 days. Isn't that great?
That is great. And it's great if you know what you're looking for. And that is all true. So yes, on the face of it, that is fantastic. So if you know what you want, Amazon is the world's repository of books that are available. Undoubtedly, that is true. However, most people don't know what they want. Most people come across stuff because they hear about it, it's recommended to them, whether it's by that old-fashioned bookseller saying, hey, I know you really enjoyed this book, this one has just come out, or I've just discovered this one, I think you'd like that one too. Or however else someone hears about a book, an idea, whatever it is. So as a repository of stuff, which is all Amazon is, it's a fantastic warehouse of stuff. But you have to know that you want that 12-point ball peen hammer to buy it on Amazon. Similarly, you have to know that you want book X to buy it on Amazon. The trick is, if no one knows books, you know, A through Z minus X don't exist, how is anyone ever going to know they exist? And how is, therefore, will there be any way of a book trade, professionally speaking, let alone a culture or a political movement, which will be able to sustain and interact with such ideas or such literature? So what we've seen, so the Amazon phenomenon coupled with kind of digital technology means that more and more and more, it's easier to make your own stuff, digitally speaking. You can make your own book, you can make your own CD, you can make your own movie, and Amazon will list it for you, presuming that you have an ISBN number or a UPC code, which can be purchased. So it means that more and more people are producing stuff than ever before. So when I mentioned earlier that the total sales in the US are shrinking every year and have done since 2007, This is in the same context that more and more books are being published every year. So since this current decade, I think 2009 or 2010 was the first year that there was more than 1 million books published that year alone. So there's a veritable deluge of books coming out. Amazon, I believe, you know, stocks, 40 million books and 40 million other, you know, items, I'm sure. How in the hell are you going to know that any of these books actually exist to go and buy them really cheaply on Amazon? So the challenge, as always, is actually the dissemination, not the point of purchase.
So I want to make one little point, and then I want to go to history for a second. And the little point is what you said about the ball peen hammer really struck home to me, because I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a hardware store and said, I need to do this bit of, you know, home repair type stuff, and I have no idea what I need. And so I could, you know, go to Amazon, or I could go to a place without educated customer service, and I would come home with, I might have to make 7 trips because I go in and I buy the wrong hammer, wrong screwdriver, wrong whatever it is.
Yep.
Whereas a knowledgeable person would be able to say, well, you know, here are the tools you need. And it's the same with bookstores. I'm just that helped me get it.
Well, I think of people that shop regularly on Amazon, and I happen to know some people that do so. So, for example, this person I know, who shall remain nameless, buys all of their shoes on Amazon. So 3 out of 4 of every shoe they purchase is sent back because it's slightly the wrong size, because, of course, you haven't tried the shoe on before purchasing it. So you discover it's not quite what you expected, or it's slightly too tight or slightly too wide or not wide enough or whatever. So again, that's an incredibly inefficient way purely on the personal scale, it's a very inefficient way of shopping, shall we say, let alone all the other wider ramifications of consumer culture, what that entails.
Well, yeah, that was one of the things that was being left off, is I have a commitment that once every month I buy a book from Jefferson State Books because I want to support him. And so there's also the whole neighborhood community support as opposed to buying from Amazon. But there's another point I want to make too, about digital versus tactile, I guess, experience, in that I live in a really tiny town, and there is the closest university library is about 70 miles. And that has been the one thing I don't like about here. And the reason I want to bring this up is because when I've done research before in libraries, it's one thing to sort of bop around the internet, and it's great that I can type in a search for Germany coal consumption 2014 and stuff pops up immediately. That's pretty cool. But in terms of research, honestly, when I've done research in libraries, what'll happen is I'm looking up child labor, and I'm looking up all sorts of books on that. And then all of a sudden my eye falls on a book on Irish immigration that would not have otherwise. And suddenly I have another chapter in cultural make-believe. And there's this immersion in physical books. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been doing research and I will end up writing about something completely different because I was surrounded by 1,000 books.
I mean, I think that, I mean, so as we kind of start drifting into the social implications.
Oh, before we do that, there's one more direction I want to go. I just want to be clear on something. When you were saying that there wasn't women's fiction prior to, you know, a category, women's fiction, prior to the 1960s/70s. So does this mean that sort of the golden age of publishing would have been the 70s, not the 1930s or 20s or 40s? Because I actually want to understand this in terms of, are you saying that, because I think about, you know, sometimes we talk about the 30s or 40s as sort of a golden age of publishing in some ways, but that's very much a sort of golden age of white male publishing, right?
I think it's of different genres. Because, I mean, so most people, publishing is both incredibly old and incredibly new. and is largely predicated on two things. One is technological innovation, and secondly is social movements. So I'll explain that very simply. Obviously, before the printing press, there was no publishing. There was publishing, of course, but it was a very laborious and hence very, very elite. You know, books were written by hand, typically by religious people, you know, by clerics, whether they were in the West, Christian, or whether they were in the East, you know, Islam, or whether they're in the Far East and they were Chinese, whatever. You know, until the invention of the printing press, the dissemination of print was obviously very limited, and hence those that could interact with them was equally very limited. And so as each kind of different technological revolution has happened, that has altered the availability and the accessibility of print. So when we head to the kind of 19th century, People didn't read books. They read books as excerpts. So lots of the kind of classic 19th century literature was published as articles, and not articles, or I guess it'd be chapters. Each chapter would be in a magazine. So, you know, you'd pay a penny or whatever it was, and you'd get your latest chapter of the new Charles Dickens novel or the new Sherlock Holmes novel.
And I can't believe that little Nell died.
So, you know, that was the way that people actually interacted with print, so to speak, was as kind of like subscriptions to a magazine, if you like. So one of the and books as such were hardcover, hence less accessible, more expensive, a more complicated binding process. So the revolution that I think you're alluding to in the 30s was the so-called paperback revolution, where various people started to bring out books in paperback and hence made them. Often I say it was these collections of these anthologies of serials, if you like, of different books. But that made them, again, more affordable, more cheaper and easier to distribute, hence. So I say there's these kind of technological, so to speak, things that are going on. Concomitant to that is basically if you look at publishing, it's all to do with social movements and politics. I mean, you know, going back hundreds, thousands of years, it's all about politics. You know, Islam was an incredibly rich literary society. And, you know, there are libraries of, you know, the mullahs of wherever or the, you know, that had libraries of hundreds of thousands of volumes. So Islam was a culture which held up learning and reading and education in the highest esteem. Whereas in the West, it was the preserve of the Catholic Church, basically. So again, if folk remember the struggles, I don't remember. Obviously, everyone is too young to remember. But if folk think of their history, the struggles, for example, to get the Bible out of Latin into English, for example. Then there was the revolution of the invention of the printing press. And that meant that pamphlets, handbills, flyers would be easy to disseminate. At the same time, you see at every time there is massive social upheaval, you see a huge flourishing of both ideas and hence the way that those ideas are conveyed. So the first massive upheaval post-printing press in Britain was the so-called English Revolution, 1640 to 1660, where again there was the so-called roundheads and cavaliers. You know, the king was beheaded. Britain was briefly a republic headed by the great dictator and mass murderer Oliver Cromwell. But also there was this kind of revolution from below. People may remember the diggers, the levelers, or heard of these folks. And so the English Revolution had this massive outpouring of literature, both of right-wing and left-wing. So not only did the ranters and the levelers and the diggers and the Gerard Wyn Stanleys and the Ebenezer Cops produce their tracts, their pamphlets, but seemingly the right wing did. You know, the monarchists, the loyalists also produced their kind of literature. The same could be said of the French Revolution, 1789 in France. There was an insane outpouring of literature, both from the right and the left. So both both in France and then also in America, in Britain, again for or against the French Revolution. Edmund Burke wrote his famous attack on the French Revolution. Americans are perhaps familiar with the great hero of American liberty, Tom Paine, who's actually British and ended up in America. So Tom Paine's Rights of Man, actually, sorry, it was his pamphlet Common Sense when it came out around about the time of the French Revolution. That sold 100,000 copies in the UK alone. And that was at a time when the entire population of the UK was only 6 million, the vast majority of whom were illiterate. Nevertheless, Common Sense, I repeat, sold 100,000 copies. And then we've already mentioned how the 60s and 70s produced this massive outburst of different kinds of literature. So, say, you can see this kind of stuff rises and falls, say, for these kind of two reasons. And I've forgotten where I was kind of going with that, really, other than just laying out these kind of two forces at work.
I think I interrupted you when you were saying, when you were going to talk about the social and political effects of the this collapse of the book industry, this collapse of dissemination down to one company disseminating things, Amazon, etc.
Well, yeah.
And we never have really talked about who cares? Why would anybody care about this except for those mid-list authors who then had to go to work either at a university or doing landscaping jobs?
Well, I guess there are two reasons. The one where anyone would care. And that is, ideas matter. And again, wherever one is on the political spectrum, everyone agrees, whether you are Joseph Stalin or whether you're, you know, the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, everyone agrees that ideas matter. But there's a classic Stalin quote of saying, you know, we wouldn't give our enemies arms, so why would we give them ideas? And, you know, in that sense, he's absolutely right. So culture, again, whether explicitly political or not, ideas have always been a terrain that has been fought over by anyone and everyone, whether they are political with a capital P or not, whether they're involved in social movements and want to change the world, or whether they want to preserve the status quo or not, and everyone in between. Everyone, wittingly or unwittingly, has actually always been involved in that kind of war of ideas. And in, I say, most other places, whether it's in Stalin's Soviet Union or an emergent third world, ideas, poetry, music, art, culture has always been seen as indispensable, not only to the health of a well-rounded human being, but as an indispensable part of any kind of radical revolutionary struggle. Equally, the right wing are very well aware. I mean, one of the successes of the right here in America was the so-called culture wars of the, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, is like, well, we will just deflect people from the fact that they no longer, that, you know, their pay packet is worth less now than it was in 1980 by the fact that they should be really bothered about kind of real non-issues like whether gays should be allowed to marry or not. So again, everyone is involved in these struggles. And everyone participates in these struggles.
And how...
My point being that everyone thinks actually these ideas do matter.
And how does a conglomeration... How does a centralization of publishing and or distribution, how does that influence, to use a value neutral word, the promulgation of ideas, especially for those of us who care about, those of us who are not right wing?
Well, as I said, and again, while I was thinking about that question, you know, the right has always been incredibly aware of ideas and the fact that they matter. So let's just take the role of education. Now, you know, the vast majority of people in the Western world and most other places, you know, value education. And education is typically provided by the state, and that is a good thing. Hence, that has always been a battleground. It's been a battleground over the basics such as literacy. But more importantly, so recently, again, recently meaning, say, post-Second World War, when a lot of this kind of, that kind of state education became universal, became a massive battleground. So what is actually taught in schools is now crucially important. So again, to take the kind of right/liberal divide, you know, should in this country, which apparently there's separation of church and state, supposedly enshrined in the Constitution, do we teach creationism in schools? I mean, creationism, of course, being that the Bible is literally true, which there's very, very little science to bear that out. So do we teach a scientific approach to history, to archaeology, to society, or do we teach a biblical approach? Again, that's a very real and live battle that's been going on for the last, 30 or 40 years. And similarly, hence the battle over who controls local school boards, who controls, so again, if we're talking about the big corporations, who controls what gets put in school textbooks, let alone which textbooks are actually part of any curriculum for students. These are kind of ongoing vital issues. So to answer your question, if the conglomerates, if those in power have the power to say, for example, with national or state or even local school district education, what gets to be taught and hence what one is allowed to read, what ideas one is allowed to interact with, that has a massive difference, obviously, in the shaping, the furtherance of those ideas and hence society and culture as a whole. I mean, that's just one example of a kind of an obvious in-your-face example of why this can make a difference.
So how would it affect social discourse? Okay, I understand what you're saying about the difference between a local bookstore that can make a recommendation based on a human relationship and, you know, Lord knows from my writing that I understand the difference between a human relationship and going to Amazon. But how then would that shift toward simply popping onto Amazon to buy a book, how would that affect society? What are the larger macro effects of that?
Well, I think the larger macro effects are partly, of course, when we're talking about ideas, or indeed more particularly talking about the book trade or publishing or the dissemination of books, is we can't take this out of context of what's going on in the wider world and the wider society and machinations of capital and the state. And what I mean by that is the large conglomerates, and it's increasingly few, have their own peculiarly and only financial interests at heart. What's going to turn a quick profit? That is their only interest. They're actually not interested in adult literacy. They're not interested in a diversity of ideas, of opinions. They're not interested in the joys of learning. They're not interested in, as is fairly evident in, you know, funding institutions like libraries just because they are, quote, a good thing for society. So this kind of wider effect is going on, meaning people's abilities, people's avenues, people's ways to even come in contact with, let me rephrase that. What is one's gateway to ideas? As I've argued previously in this conversation, Amazon is only a gateway if you already know the idea you're looking for. Again, you gave the example of being immersed in a library and just kind of, not randomly, but kind of semi-randomly, you know, discovering ancillary ideas or avenues through your research because you were immersed in a particular broad field. So how do we, what are those portals?
Wait,
what are those gateways to those ideas?
Wait, thank you. Sorry to interrupt, but this is so important to me that the most important book I ever read in my life was The Natural Alien by Neil Everton. And I came across that book because I was just walking down the stacks at the Spokane Public Library, and the book jumped off the shelf at me. And that couldn't have happened on Amazon. Go ahead.
So the difference between a library or a bookstore, again, irrespective of the quality, because obviously not every library, not every bookstore is good, you know, and again, whatever good means, whatever value judgment that is. And nevertheless, you can't browse Amazon. You can browse in a library. You can browse in a bookstore. So by its very definition, that expands your options. Whereas no one goes to Amazon and idly flicks, you know, idly types in random search things and sees what comes up. And maybe they do. I don't know. But I'd be willing to bet that is not the case. But the wider thing going on to kind of also kind of brought up again in society. So again, I argued earlier in this conversation about the importance of social movements, of kind of engendering and both engendering and nurturing and being part of that wider conversation, shall we say, about literature, about ideas. Equally, it was generally considered, for example, for many, many decades in the 20th century, that adult literacy was a good thing. Period. And hence, most people read. Now, again, irrespective of the quality of what they were reading, you know, 20, 30 years ago, most people read a daily paper. Even if that daily paper was a load of garbage, they were actually reading a daily paper. Now, virtually no one reads a daily paper, whether it's, you know, so-called quality or not. Similarly, the culture is such that people, for example, don't write letters anymore. People don't correspond. You know, sending someone a text or sending them a one-line email is not corresponding. So the whole art and culture and banal, I don't know what we call it really. Reading and writing basically are rapidly ceasing to exist. And I think that has huge ramifications for society as a whole. Secondly, the way that people still read, there's been various studies in the last kind of decade done again, typically by not radical revolutionary folks, typically by, you know, kind of think tanks at places like Stanford or, you know, so kind of right wing conservative with a small C kind of places. But they're pretty conclusive that the way people now interact with information. So, again, you gave the example in the past of being immersed in a tactile library surrounded by books or words and print, and you can hold it and you can discover it and you can leaf through it. The way most people now read is online, whether it's their newspaper or whether it's articles or whether it's whatever. And I say there's been these kind of studies which pretty conclusively show that not only is hence the art of long form reading, since most people now read short bits, they no longer read a novel, they no longer read a book, they no longer read a nonfiction book, now they dip into something. They no longer read a newspaper from cover to cover on a Sunday over a nice cup of coffee and a whatever you eat with your coffee. Now you'll dip into it online. So that kind of long form reading and hence long form thinking has pretty much gone out the window. To make matters worse, again, these studies show fairly conclusively that the distractions of reading something online, all the hyperlinks, all the kind of ads flashing on the margins, that further actually affects one's brain. So again, these studies have shown that the introduction of reading of print, say 500 years ago, actually affected evolutionary humans' brains and hence the way they interacted with and processed ideas. Now what we're seeing in the last decade is the kind of similar thing in reverse. Our brains and the way we interact with information and ideas are now being, again, this is according to kind of right-wing mainstream conservative scholars, scientists, think tanks, is actually being literally degraded.
So we have only like 3 minutes left or 2 minutes left, and I would love to have you on again, if you would be, to talk specifically about that, not about the collapse of the book industry, but we'll start from that point that you just said about the degrading of thinking and long form reading. I would love to talk about that as someone who writes 700 page books. But in the short term, everything you're saying, it seems so important. In the short term, in the next couple minutes, can you give us what you think is the, say, short to mid-term, by which I mean 3 to 6 years, future of the book industry?
I think the book industry has already pretty much ended up like the record industry, which I used that analogy before, meaning that folks who are interested in music will probably notice that there's been a, quote, resurgence of vinyl. So when I say that it's analogous to the music industry, again, over the last kind of 10, 15 years, the music industry has pretty much collapsed, meaning people no longer actually consume, for want of a less loaded term, music. So in the year 2000, this is long before downloading became ubiquitous, so we can't blame that, there were more CDs were replaced as the top-selling item by video games. So in a literal sense, people no longer read. They no longer listen to music. They actually play video games. So music has kind of been degraded into a niche, so to speak, where people now, kind of connoisseurs, listen to vinyl. However, the typical print run, or the pressing, or whatever, of this vinyl is somewhere between 500 and a few thousand. And I include this of, kind of major label artists. I have a friend who works at Rough Trade Records in the UK, and he said that they have one of these kind of exclusive, Record of the Month Club. And he said major labels with major label artists, and their Record of the Month Club, they do 1,500 copies. He said major labels and major label artists are happy to give them exclusive material, meaning these majors are happy to sell now 1,500 copies of something. That's how dire it is in that sense. And basically, we're seeing the same with books. I mean, I say I've been involved in publishing for the last close to 40 years now. My typical print run of something that I've published has been, 3,000 to 5,000. That's pretty damn niche, unfortunately. I wish it was, 10 times that amount. And that has remained the same. But I think that the kind of the major labels are struggling, if they're honest and willing, to try and find ways of making that model work, in the same way that they're struggling and largely failing to find that kind of vinyl model work for them. I mean, I think that's what's happening.
Well, that's depressing.
I mean, it's actually considerably worse than that. I mean, part of the problem is the book trade is disintegrating. No one is even willing to talk about it or acknowledge it. And secondly, what the major labels are doing, other than the kind of typical mergers and acquisitions, again, as folk may remember, in the last year, Penguin merged with Random House. So two of the big five merged. And again, that's never an expansion. That means they're laying off half their staff, half their authors, blah, blah, blah. But on top of that, in the last year, basically Penguin Random House announced their deal of how they're going to deal with this new situation. And that is they set up a new publishing company called Author House that they claim, which I'm sure is true, pays 50% royalties, which is fantastic. What the fine print doesn't say is that the author pays for everything. So basically, they are reinventing themselves as publishers, as a kind of pay-to-play organization, meaning you pay us, we'll publish your book. That's the future of mainstream publishing.
Well, we're over time, but sorry to do this, but can you give us any positive thing for the future to end on, or give us anything to end on? What is your last two sentences for this fabulous interview?
Well, as I said, I would argue that ideas and politics and radical change and literacy rises and falls with social movements. So our only hope is to keep on fighting the good fight and build social movements which actually make a real change in the world. If we don't have that, not only is reading and literacy lost, but we're all kind of doomed. So, the choice is ours.
Well, I really couldn't agree more. So thank you so much for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ramsey Kanaan. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.